We come now to the second half of our study in the man John Mark. Now could you turn, please, to the last chapter of Paul's letter to the Colossians? And just to pick up the story, we saw that Mark had engaged in quite an extensive ministry with Peter, and the association between Mark and Peter was so close that Peter could refer to Mark as his son in the same sense that Paul could refer to Timothy as his son. What I'm going to speak about today is Mark's activity as the gospel writer. If my first study could be called Mark the Young Man, this study would be called Mark the Gospel Writer. First of all, some information that you don't get from the Bible. Round about the time that Paul was imprisoned in Palestine, you know, towards the end of the book of Acts, Paul was imprisoned in Jerusalem and in Caesarea, the Roman governors Felix and Festus, and then he was sent on the sea voyage to Rome. The ship was wrecked and they finished up on Malta, and finally they made it to Rome. Remember that story? Well, during that time, Peter, with Mark as his assistant, had come to Rome and spent some time with the church there, teaching it concerning the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. After some time, Peter left, and the Roman Christians asked Mark to write down the story of Jesus as they had heard it from Peter. Mark did this, and the result was Mark's gospel. In the meantime, Paul had been sailing for Rome. With him on the ship, as well as a lot of other prisoners, were a man called Aristarchus and another man called Luke. Luke was the writer of the book of Acts, and you find in the story that he refers to himself quite frequently. He says, "We did this, and then we did something else, and we got in the boat, and we landed here, and we headed for such and such a place." The writer is one of the people on board the ship with Paul. Paul, Aristarchus, and Luke are all mentioned. Finally, they arrived in Rome, and Paul was imprisoned in Rome for 2 years. And during this time, he wrote a number of letters. One of them was this letter to the Colossians. And at the end of the letter, he sends greetings to the church, and various people with him join in sending greetings. In verse 10, Aristarchus, his fellow prisoner, the man who had come with him all the way from Palestine, Aristarchus sends greetings, and so does Mark, the cousin of Barnabas. Notice how he says that Mark here is to be of benefit to the church in Colossae. Paul recommends him to the church as being one who can help it. Aristarchus, Mark, and in verse 14, Luke. So those three are together with Paul in Rome. If you read Paul's letter to Philemon, you'd find the same three men are mentioned as being with Paul. Philemon was the Christian in whose house the Colossian church met, and the letters to Colossians and Philemon were written by Paul at the same time and sent off together. From Colossians we learn that these three men and a few others, and specifically we're referring now to Mark and Luke, but these three, Aristarchus, Mark and Luke, are all together with Paul in Rome. And if you read Philemon, you'd find that the three men are actually mentioned all in the same verse. Now Luke also had been writing his gospel. He had been writing for an important man called Theophilus. He was apparently a Roman, or a high official in the Roman administration. And Luke had set out to give him a trustworthy account of the growth of Christianity from the birth of its founder to the arrival of its greatest apostle in Rome. It was so long that the book was divided into two parts. Part 1, which goes from the birth of Jesus to his resurrection, we call the Gospel of Luke. Part 2, which goes from the resurrection of Jesus to the arrival of Paul in Rome, we call the Acts of the Apostles. At the beginning of both parts, we find that Theophilus is mentioned. and Luke points out that he had been researching his material and gathering together facts to prepare this trustworthy account of the rise and development of Christianity. He had been with Paul, Luke had been with Paul in Palestine during those 2 years' imprisonment under the Roman governors Felix and Festus, and no doubt he used that time well to speak with eyewitnesses and to look up records and to prepare his account. When he arrived in Rome, you can imagine his delight to find Mark there and to find that Mark had already written an account. And you can imagine the discussions the two of them must have had together. And no doubt Luke asked Mark if he could take some of those stories from Mark's gospel and incorporate them into his own. They were writing for quite different people, of course, just as Matthew was writing for somebody different again. I'm sure they had no idea that one day all their different writings would be collected together in one book and maybe would be read in countries all around the world thousands of years later. But we have different gospels because different people were writing for different people in different places at different times and for different purposes. Well, Mark, of course, was only too pleased to let Luke use some of the material, and that's why it is that you have a number of sections in Luke and Mark which are very, very similar. But I'm concerned here with Mark and his gospel and how it reflects the ministry of Peter. There's no doubt that over the years Mark has changed from that impetuous young man to one now who is quite a respected Christian, quite a respected leader in the church. There's no doubt that Mark learnt much simply through growing up. Time is one of those ingredients which is necessary for any development. In fact, the very word development implies that there must be time. But Mark has worked with different people, and no doubt he has learnt. He had a time with Paul. He worked for a longer time with Barnabas. He worked for an even longer time with Peter. And all of these experiences helped to teach him and helped his gifts to develop. There's no doubt that we can learn a lot from our association with Christian workers. Young men can learn, and older ones likewise can be of benefit to others. I think we have to be alert. And those who have gained experience should be pleased to encourage younger ones to associate with them and to benefit from this experience. And younger ones should be looking for the opportunity of learning from the experience of other people. And so it's a two-way thing. And Mark here has benefited. And hats off also to Paul and Barnabas and Peter for the way they have helped this young man to grow. But I think if there's one thing that has really helped Mark, it must have been his understanding of the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. He had heard Peter preach and he had helped Peter in his preaching, and now he had written down the message as he had heard it from Peter. No doubt he had heard it dozens and dozens of times, and it wasn't very difficult for him to recall the exact words of Peter and so to write down this account. And in the process, he had been changed, contemplating the person of Christ from one degree of glory to another. So we are being changed into his likeness. I believe in evangelical churches in general, we have impoverished ourselves to some extent through our neglect of the Gospels. We're great followers of the Apostle Paul. We believe in the great truths of justification by faith and so on. In fact, even the other apostles are looked upon as being a little second rate at times. Of course, I know we wouldn't put it in those terms. We say it's all the inspired word of God and we accept it as scripture. But I think in the backs of people's minds there is that unspoken attitude that somehow the writings of Paul are on a level a little bit above the writings of James and Peter and John, and in some cases even on a pedestal above the Gospels. And the Gospels very often are used only as a means of providing us with material to teach Sunday school lessons or to provide us with gospel sermons. But the gospels have to be read in their own light, in their own right, rather. Here the person of Christ, his life and ministry, his teaching, that which became the very foundation upon which Paul and the other apostles built, here it is given to us in its fullness, and we are the poorer if we neglect to study the person of Christ, his ministry and his teaching in the Gospels, and to see how this applies to us and see how it is used as the basis from which the other apostles worked in their ministry. Let us now look at Mark's Gospel, and what I want to do is to see some of the influences of Peter in Mark's Gospel, and see also how Mark's Gospel was particularly concerned with presenting the message for non-Jewish readers in Rome. Mark's Gospel begins, more or less, at the point where Peter becomes a disciple. You find there is no reference to the nativity stories in Mark. It very much reflects Peter's own experience and Peter's own viewpoint, and so it begins roughly at the point where he becomes a disciple. And you find that most of the stories center around Peter's home territory in Galilee. In fact, if you only had Mark, you wouldn't know that Jesus had any ministry in Jerusalem apart from a few days prior to his crucifixion, because the whole of the story is concerned with Galilee, and particularly with Capernaum, which is where Peter lived. And Jesus' story radiates out from Capernaum in the Gospel of Mark. In fact, I believe that Jesus made Peter's home his headquarters. And you get references in Mark to Jesus being at home. It was just taken for granted that that's where his home was, Peter's mother-in-law being sick, where Jesus was living in that home. And so there are many references there in Mark, indicating that that was Jesus' headquarters for much of the time that he spent in Galilee. Another feature is the way the story tends to rush on. We all know that Mark is the shortest of the Gospels, and in most cases the story in Mark will be shorter than the parallel account that you get in the other Gospels. This again reflects something of the character of Peter, and also of Mark for that matter, because they seem to have been tarred with the same brush. A certain impetuosity, let's get on with the facts, and you find that they give you the bare details and don't embellish their stories, they don't build them up, they don't expand. And it just rushes on, and after this, that happened, and then immediately something else happened, and straightway this happened. It's very obvious in the Greek, but in any version of the English Bible, you'll find these expressions such as immediately, straightway, and after this, and then. It just tumbles on like a stream tumbling over the rocks, reflecting again the style of Peter and the style of Mark. A number of things, however, are worth noting, which point even more to the figure of Peter behind Mark. There are a number of omissions. Things which would tend to put Peter in a favourable light are omitted, because Peter wouldn't want to give the impression that he was blowing his own trumpet. Peter walking on the sea, for example, you find that story is omitted, or that reference to his walking on the sea omitted, because he doesn't want to convey the impression that he's boasting. More significantly, in the case where Jesus said, "Who do you say that I am?" and Peter made that remarkable statement, "You are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Now that's recorded in Mark, as it is in the other Gospels. But Jesus' special blessing on Peter is omitted. "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." You find that there's nothing about that in Mark's Gospel, even though Mark mentions Peter's confession. He does not mention Jesus' special blessing. for the same reason, that naturally Peter is being modest, whereas the other writers don't hesitate to mention it. On the other hand, things which are less favourable to Peter, and which the other writers tend to play down or not mention at all, are given in greater detail in Mark. Take, for example, the story on the Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus appears there, and with him Moses and Elijah. And it says in Mark that Peter, feeling he ought to say something, is a bit embarrassed over the silence, and, you know, what are we to do here? And it says that Peter, not knowing what to say, said, well, let's build three booths, one each, for Jesus and Elijah and Moses. It's a rather silly thing to say. And a voice came and said, this is my beloved son. He is unique. You can't put Moses and Elijah on the same plane as Jesus Christ. But you see how Peter doesn't hesitate to tell that story, whereas the other two, who would tend to be kind to Peter and not include those details, leave them out. His denial of Jesus, now there is one story that you find is given in greater detail in Mark than in the other Gospels. How Peter denied Jesus. Once again, the man expressing the facts as they are, without any apology, and no doubt with a great sense of humility and shame. So whereas the other two just go a little softly on Peter, you find Peter is quite ruthless with himself in presenting the story. And so these again are indications of the ministry of Peter being reflected in the writing of Mark. And probably the most touching of them all is in the final chapter of Mark, where Jesus says after the resurrection, I'm going into Galilee, go and tell my disciples and Peter that I'll meet them there. And those words, and Peter, must have meant much to a forgiven Peter. And Mark alone records them. So much for those indications of the influence of Peter. I want now to look at some of the Aramaic expressions that are explained for the benefit of the Roman readers. The Romans were not very familiar with Jewish ways, and certainly they were not familiar with the Aramaic language, which was the language that Jesus and the apostles spoke. Mark and these other New Testament writers, when they write, are writing in Greek. So they're not actually writing the words of Jesus, because Jesus spoke Aramaic, so what they're writing is a translation of those words into Greek. But every now and again you'll find they slip in Aramaic words, as if the words of Jesus just kept ringing in their ears, and they felt they had to put those words in, and then they give a little translation so that the readers will understand. Now you find this very common in Mark, because the Roman readers would not have understood the Aramaic language. Chapter 3, verse 17, James and John, who are a couple of hotheads, were nicknamed by Jesus Boanerges, which doesn't mean anything to anybody who doesn't know what the word Boanerges means. But it was an Aramaic word, and it means sons of thunder. So he explains this so that the Roman readers will get the message. Chapter 5, verse 41. The daughter of Jairus. Remember that Peter, James and John were the only three apostles who witnessed this miracle. And as Jesus took the child by the hand, he said, Talitha kumai. And Peter felt that he just had to say those words. Those words must have been so impressed upon his mind that when he told the story, he said, that's what Jesus said. But then, of course, it has to be translated for these people who don't understand the language that Jesus was speaking. They don't understand Aramaic. And so he says, that means, little girl, I say to you, arise. Chapter 7, verse 11, refers to the word Corban. Now, they wouldn't have known what Corban meant any more than we would. Unless, of course, somebody explained it. And so again, Mark puts it in brackets. Corban means given to God. And later on in the same chapter, verse 34, the healing of the man who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech. Looking to heaven, Jesus sighed and said, "Ephphatha," which means "be opened." And so you have these translations made for the benefit of the readers. Not only that, but various Jewish customs are explained. There are other illustrations, incidentally, concerning this translation matter, but I think you've got enough to get the point. You see, there was quite an anti-Jewish feeling in Rome. You may recall a story in Acts chapter 18 where one of the earlier emperors had expelled all the Jews from Rome. Well, in time, we find that the Jews had dribbled back. But even in the Roman church, there was still quite a strong anti-Jewish feeling, so much so that when Paul earlier had written his letter to the Romans, he had to warn the Gentile Christians, the Italians, not to despise the Jews. They said, "Oh, the Jews are on the scrap heap now, they're thrown out, God's got no use for them." And Paul said, "Don't you adopt that attitude, or you might find yourselves on the scrap heap." And then later on in the book, he has to deal with the problem that some of the Italians were despising the Jews because some of the Jews had a few hang-ups over the sort of food they should eat and certain religious festivals and holy days that they had been accustomed to keep in the past. And Paul has to say to them, "Look, you chaps, be tolerant and realize that these chaps just have a whole background of Jewish tradition, and they may not feel as emancipated as you are." Now, the Jews weren't trying to impose these as regulations on other people, but he said, "Be tolerant of them and just understand that they have certain difficulties because of the way they've been brought up." You see, again, that anti-Jewish feeling didn't take long to surface in Rome. They didn't really understand the Jews. That's what it boils down to. And so when Mark writes his gospel, as no doubt when Peter preached to them, they had to explain certain things. Chapter 7, opening verses. We find the Pharisees and the scribes have criticized Jesus because some of his disciples ate with hands defiled. That's explained as meaning unwashed. And then in verses 3 and 4 you find a very long parenthesis where Mark explains, for the benefit of the Roman readers, he says, "The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands, observing the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they purify themselves. And there are many other traditions which they observe, the washing of cups and pots and vessels of bronze." And then he goes back in verse 5 to continue the story. It's as if I were telling you a story about Thailand and a Thai custom cropped up in the story, and I just stopped to explain it before going further, otherwise you're not going to get the point of the story. Chapter 12, verse 18. Talking here about the Sadducees. You know that there were two major parties in the Jews, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He says the Sadducees came to him, and then he explains, these are the ones that say there is no resurrection, because the story he's going to talk about has to do with the resurrection. And if you don't get the significance of the fact that it was Sadducees who asked this story, well, then the point that asked this question rather, then the point of the story may be lost. It's again as if I were telling some people in Thailand about political events in Australia, and I talked about the Labour Party and the Liberal Party, and it means nothing to them. But supposing when I'm making a certain point, I say, "Now the Labour Party, that's the party that is based more on the trade union movement," and then I go on to explain the story, so that they now get the point of what I'm getting at. So it is here that you have to explain these things for people that otherwise may not know. Down in verse 42 of the same chapter, two coins which equal a penny. He has to give a Roman equivalent of the couple of coins that the widow put into the treasury. Once again, I could tell you that somebody put 100 baht into the offering in Thailand. You wouldn't know whether that was a lot of money or little money unless I gave you the equivalent in our own currency. Chapter 15, verse 42. When the evening had come, since it was the day of preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, the Italians wouldn't have known what the day of preparation was, but Mark explains that it's the day prior to the Sabbath. Well, there are again just a few examples one could go on, but you can see how the writer is making his message relevant to his audience, and I hope we can all see a message for ourselves in that. The need to explain things and not to assume that people know all these theological terms that we use, or that they know who Abraham was and where Moab was and where Bethlehem is and all the rest of it. We have to explain things if we're going to get the message across. Well, finally, Jesus Christ as the servant. Now, we've heard it said before that each of the Gospels present Jesus as something different. One, he's the king, in one, he's the servant, in one, he's something else. Well, there may be an element of truth in those things, but we must be very careful of becoming too stereotyped, or even artificial. Mark, of course, is said to be the one that presents Jesus as the servant, and there's no doubt that Mark does present him as a man of action, a man of hard work, a man of great devotion to his duty, a perfect servant, and this, of course, is something that appealed to the energetic, hard-working Romans. But the real point that Mark is making is that, yes, Jesus is the servant, but he's the suffering servant. He is the Messiah who is the servant. And it's the Son of Man who is the servant. That's really one of the main points that Mark makes. And by the Son of Man, it doesn't merely mean that Jesus was human. It may mean that, yes, but it means a lot more. It's not just that Jesus was a man. The Son of Man is an expression that has its origins in the Old Testament, and it was used of the Messiah, the heavenly Son of Man, the divinely sent person. And what Mark is saying is this, that the Messiah, the Son of God, the Son of Man, the heavenly sent figure, the Davidic king, this same one, is the suffering servant. Now Jesus himself had said that, following Peter's confession, "You are the Christ, you are the Messiah." Jesus said, "Yes, and you will see." I beg your pardon. "Yes," he said, and he began to teach them that the Son of Man, the Messiah, must suffer many things. And when he was before the high priest said, "Look, I'm asking you these questions. Why don't you answer me? Tell me, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Are you the Messiah, the Son of God?" And Jesus said, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." And that's a direct quote from Daniel chapter 7, where this heavenly Son of Man is mentioned. The Son of Man, the Messiah, the Son of God, they are all the same person, and that person is Jesus. And the high priest says this is blasphemy, and of course he condemns Jesus to death. Now if you look at chapter 10, please, we'll just look at a couple of verses here, where we find that that great messianic figure, the Son of God, the Son of Man, the Messiah, is the suffering servant. It is always the case that the way to glory is through suffering. The way to exaltation is through being a servant. And that is the great lesson that I'd like us to take away from the Gospel of Mark. We are servants, even as the Son of Man was a servant. And we've got to learn to serve each other as he served us. There was this dispute, who would be the greatest among the disciples? Jesus says in chapter 10, verse 43, "It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man also came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And we are to be servants as the Son of Man was a servant, and we're to give ourselves for the sake of others.